This is Fresh Air. We're featuring interviews from our archives for this New Year's Day, and we've chosen one we hope will help you laugh off any lingering hangover. This is a 1990 interview with John Cleese, founding member of the British comedy group Monty Python's Flying Circus, star of the British TV comedy series Fawlty Towers, and star of the 1988 comedy A Fish Called Wanda. Lately, his performances have been in TV commercials. It wasn't comedy that brought the former minister of Silly Walks to Philadelphia in 1990. John Cleese came to the city to participate in a family therapy conference. He led a seminar with his former therapist, Robin Skinner. The two collaborated on the 1983 book, Families and How to Survive Them. You'll actually hear Skinner laughing in the background during our interview. Cleese's comic characterizations have skewered the businessman mentality. His father was an insurance salesman. I wanted to know if Cleese developed some of his characters by watching his father.
I think if somebody had to say, what's the thread running almost all the way through my work, it's something to do with trying to escape from a sort of rather narrow, rather respectable, lower middle class inhibition. And that's really what my work's been about, if I think about it. And Wanda was a supreme example of that, where Archie Fine sort of throws it all up and disappears to Rio with Jamie Lee Curtis, you know. So I think that that's probably been informing my work more than anything else, along, I think, with two other things. I think that people in their work, comedians, often try and laugh at the thing that frightens them most and attempt to sort of make it less threatening. And I've always been scared of anger. The English are very uncomfortable with anger. I don't know if it's anything particularly to do with my family, but it's certainly to do with the English family, more than the British family, if you see what I mean. They hate anger. They regard it as a loss of face to really, you know, sound off. And they find it very difficult to express it, and so they get pushed around a bit, and they don't complain well if they get bad service. And the other thing is that because of, I think, something early in my life, too, I've always been very scared of lack of communications. I've laughed at that a great deal.
Well, wait, can I ask you to talk in no language for a second, speaking of lack of communication?
In?
No language. You have this way of speaking in no language in particular.
Oh, the Cards and the Tebertonis. Yeah, well, they met the Glupos and never call it the Murgatuses. They're Stavila, across the bottom, part of Isaac Cruz, together in mid slever the underpedity, and fourth frame shows data vision and auditory slow perfection. But I won't go on about that at the moment. I know it's confusing if you haven't heard it before.
So is this kind of what you're doing?
Yeah, I mean, the first time I actually heard an English guy called Stanley Unwin talking that nonsense when I was 17, I mean, I laughed for about a week. I mean, I just laughed till I hurt.
How did you learn to speak in that gobbledygook?
Believe it or not, it is. When I was 18, I wrote it down, and I simply wrote it.
Really?
Yeah, the first half of words and put the second half of other words on. I can't make it up. It sounds as if I'm making it up, but that's actually something that I learned for a house entertainment at Clifton College in 1958, and I've never forgotten it. It got me into the Footlights in Cambridge, too, is how I started there.
Oh, that's great. Now, your mother was an acrobat? This happens to me all the time.
I get fed up sometimes. People send me these.
No, you know, I always, like, very seriously read, you know, these bios of the people I'm interviewing, and there's usually, like, one piece of information that is so dreadfully wrong.
That's right. I forgot I put that on some bio.
Oh, so you wrote that.
Oh, yeah.
No, I'm reading the stuff about you, and I know half of this is probably made up, and I have no idea which half it is.
That's right.
Yeah.
No, you're quite right. You get fed up fitting those biographies in, and you do put in the odd thing, and then, of course, it's played back to you a few months later. You've totally forgotten it. No, she wasn't too much of an acrobat. She was staid-ish, played the piano, and otherwise was a housewife.
You say in the book Families and How to Survive Them that most problems that we have as adults are grounded in our family experience, our early family experience. Let me ask you, John Cleese, about your early family experience. Now, your parents were in your 40s when they had you.
That's right. Dad was 46 and my mother was 40. And
your father was 46.
My father...
Yeah.
Is that what I said?
You said you were 46.
That's interesting. I was 46 when my second daughter was born.
Did you want to analyze what this means?
Many a true word spoken in jest, yes.
Yeah, I was born a little bit with pipe and slippers. I've always been rather middle-aged. That's very funny. Now, I was 46 when my second daughter was born, and I think that was kind of strange, because it's late for someone to have a child.
So were you the kid whose parents were older than all the other parents?
Absolutely, and had been married for 13 years before I arrived. And everybody was astounded when they suddenly announced they were going to have a child, because they'd been sort of marked down as not going to have children. And I think that the fact that they were old and therefore probably a bit more cautious and a bit more protective affected me. I still wince if anybody turns the television on too loudly in my house, because my mother was always saying, "Don't you know, it'll be too noisy, it'll disturb the neighbours." I've got a very, very strong sort of lower middle class respectability streak in me, which I hate.
John Cleese is my guest. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. We're listening to a 1990 interview from our archives with John Cleese.
John Cleese, who were the first people who you realized you could do convincing characterizations of?
The first dozen things I did were very derivative of things that other people had done that had made me laugh. But after that, I used the fact that if somebody is going to have a nervous tic, you know, and make chicken noises now and again, it's much funnier if they're the head of the Secret Service or the chairman of the Bank of England than if they're a tobacconist. So I used my ability to pass myself off as a sort of establishment figure because of my public school education to portray these kind of people. Because, as I say, the more serious and grave they are, the funnier it is when they start going a bit crazy.
This seems like there's a time in your life when you could have swung either way, either into the real straight life or into a parody of that.
Through writing and acting. Yeah, when I left Cambridge, I was actually signed up to join a huge firm of solicitors in the City of London called Freshfields, who were solicitors to the Bank of England, and about half the partners were lords or knights or something. So, and if the BBC hadn't come along about a week before I left Cambridge and seen the review that we were all doing, Timbrook Taylor and Bill Oddie and a number of other people who've been successful in show business and offered us all jobs, I imagine I would have gone and been a solicitor and done that for 15, 20 years before killing myself.
That's grim.
Well, I mean, no, I think if you're a solicitor, I think killing yourself is quite a cheerful prospect.
He's grinning.
Now, but you actually have a foot in the corporate world in the sense that you have a production company that does corporate training films, does advertisements for corporations.
Well, no, it's more management and sales training films. We have done a few sponsored or commissioned films for some companies in England, but that's a minority thing. It's basically the films hired by big institutions to train their employees to learn certain skills.
But still, you have to do films that have to be approved of by top executives in large corporations, right?
No, because we make them with our own money. I mean, if somebody like, for example, Volvo came to us to make a couple of commissioned films 10 years ago, I remember them because I was in them, then, of course, we very much listen to what sort of film they want to make and understand what the information or attitude that they want to put across. But that's sort of 5% of our work. 95% of it is making films with our own money. It's taken a little time to get over the fact that most of our films are humorous, and this puts people back on their heels a bit if they don't understand the difference between being serious, when I believe you can also be very funny, and being solemn. If they're confused about being serious and solemn and think that if you're being funny, you can't be being serious. If they're confused in that way, then they don't like the idea of using our film so much. But we're overcoming that resistance very rapidly. But most of our business is in the East Coast at the moment and around Chicago, as I say, where the office is.
I actually have a little clip here of one of the training films.
One of the video arts films?
Yeah, and this is one that I assume you wrote, that you star in. And this is like how to not be a repairman.
Oh, yes, the serviceman.
You play a serviceman who's called in to repair a piece of factory equipment. And the person at the factory has said that the machine is making a loud noise, and he's trying to describe it.
What sort of peculiar noise?
Oh, well, a sort of scraping.
What, a grating, or a crunching, or a high-pitched squeaking, or a harsh metallic scratching, or a hollow, full-throated humming, or a dry, reedy, sputtering, falsetto squealing, or a plangent, stridulous, crescendoing rasp, or a sibilant, twangy, clamorous, droning countertenor snorting, or...?
It was a sort of harsh, metallic sound.
What, steady, or pulsating, or measured, or intermittent, or seasonal, or cyclical, or rhythmic?
It was pulsating.
Evenly, or...
Evenly.
Staccato?
No, not staccato.
Loud?
Fairly.
So, it was a fairly loud, evenly pulsating, harsh, metallic, glissandoing, scratchy sort of peculiar noise.
Yes.
Right.
That's an excerpt from one of the training films that John Cleese's company does. That's really funny stuff. I'm wondering if you've been doing this for years.
Yeah, we founded the company in 1972, and I'm proud to say that it's now the biggest company of its kind in the world outside the States. We've been making that claim for 10 years, and I'm sure it's right because nobody's ever contested it. And I find that making the films that we do, like, for example, the recent one I made, which was on really showing a manager how to coach his subordinates, is not only very interesting, but I actually believe it's enormously worthwhile. I think it helps to move business and therefore society in slightly healthier directions and ways of operating, which very much chime in with the sort of ideas of what is mental health that Robin and I discuss all the time, which incidentally our second book's all about.
I'm sure all of our listeners are wondering, well, how come he's not making films full time? Why is he devoting so much of his time to this production company that does training films?
Well, I think it's a question of two things. First of all, a feature film is an appallingly heavy commitment. I mean, Wanda certainly took me, I think, 2 years and 2 or 3 months of my life. That's after I've squidged it all together, because it's not all in a continuous line. But so before you take 2 years to write and produce a film, because I hate acting in them, you see, I'm only prepared to do that if I've actually written them. Then it sort of becomes worthwhile to complete the circle and make the whole project done. But if you don't want to take 2 years off to make a film, and you only want to do that occasionally, then it's lovely to be able to do smaller projects here and there. And what I particularly like is any sort of project that's connected with, I suppose, the way people behave or something to do with the human mind, because this is what really interests me. The other thing is, once you've made enough money, and I've now sort of got enough money to coast, you're much more drawn to the things that really interest you than the kind of things you used to do, basically, because you were trying to build your career.
I'd like to get back to acting for a moment, John Cleese.
Oh, yes, certainly.
Why?
Well, I don't know. I was writing something that I'm going to say again when we address the conference on Friday about why I don't like being referred to as an actor.
Oh, because you write the stuff, as I imagine, part of it.
Yes, but it's something else. It's something deeper than that. I've got a resistance to it. I think it's because I know actors well, and I know they spend all their time trying to impress people, and I don't like to admit there's a bit of me that does that just as much as any other actor. You know, there's a bit of me that wishes it wasn't like that. I didn't have to impress other people so much. It's funny. It's one of the descriptions of me that always gets my hackles up. It's insane, isn't it?
John Cleese in an interview recorded in 1990. This is Fresh Air.